Hello, this is Paul Check, and welcome to yet another new edition of the PPS Success Mastery Guest Interview Series. Today, I'm really excited to share Eileen Bertelsen with you. Eileen is an actress who has plenty of experience in the field of acting. She's a very accomplished presenter. She is a Czech practitioner and a holistic lifestyle coach. And Eileen specializes in the art of communicating more effectively. Eileen's teachings help us communicate more effectively and more authentically from the core of our very being, which in my opinion is where all of our communication should come from, since the core of us is the essence or the truth of us. Eileen, welcome to the PPS Success Mastery Guest Interview Series, and thank you for sharing your precious time with me.
Thank you so much, Paul. I'm really honored to be here.
And as I announced in the introduction, you have quite a comprehensive background. Could you begin our interview by just sharing a little bit about the forces and influence in your life that led you to specialize in effective communication?
Sure, I can do that. I think it started earlier than any formal training would have been. I grew up as a middle child in a family of very expressive people. And so I started really by observing, which is such a useful part of communication, an aspect that we often overlook. And it became clear to me that different interactions would ensue and certain sort of exchanges would lead to particular results as a result of somebody addressing or approaching communication in a certain way. So it became clear that the way in which any situation unfolded was directly impacted by the nature of the communication, the nature of that exchange. So that was probably the first really formative experience that I had in taking a close look at communication and understanding how it influences our lives. And that in itself was really interesting to me. And from there, it was a natural, I guess, segue for me to look into theater and dramatic writing. And when I say dramatic, I mean anything theatrical. So it could be something funny as well. But looking at roles and relationships and character and understanding the author's or the playwright's point of view and understanding how there is a whole process of bringing those words to life. And those steps in that process are the very essence of the way we communicate. And so that, again, was another training ground for me in terms of exploring communication in another way. And as a teacher, I first started by teaching dance, for the most part of all things, and I started that very early on. And again, that sense of how to communicate with different types of people in different settings and understand that there are other factors that play in, such as in my case, because I started so young, there was an age issue where some people would respond a certain way to me because I was younger and that worked well. Other people, it was a barrier for them. So understanding how I could possibly, by adjusting my approach, keep us moving forward toward the desired result of whatever the exchange would be, whether it be disseminating information or eliciting cooperation or that kind of thing. So this is sort of a quick trip.
Well, that I can understand that process because, as you and I both know, teaching anything, particularly health and exercise, is a mode of communication whereby if the client does not actually hear and respond appropriately, they do not move correctly or live in accordance with their own stated desires and dreams, and thus we as the communicator get feedback in the form of either noncompliance or a lack of progress in our relationship with each individual.
Yes.
So certainly teaching health and exercise is a quick way to learn whether or not your communication skills are effective, isn't it?
Right. Any one-on-one coaching really points that up, whatever the field may be, and certainly because health and exercise is so physical, it's a brighter spotlight because we're not just looking to have an intellectual exchange with somebody. We're looking for that for that information or whatever our message is to actually be interpreted by the whole being, so it's really executed by all of the person. And that's a lot of assimilation, you know, that somebody assimilating something intellectually may be difficult, but being able to assimilate it and process it and then execute it physically is a whole nother bag of tricks, so to speak. And I find as instructors, and one thing that I noticed when I first got into personal training, coming from a world of teaching groups of people a lot of different things and sometimes acting, but mostly a movement kind of information would be what I would be disseminating or sharing with people. And one thing that I noticed working in the gym and looking around is that a lot of trainers, understandably, we spend a lot of time trying to get educated and so that we have a lot of information to share, and we're looking to impart that information to the client, and we're looking to see where the holes are or where we perceive those holes or those disconnects to be on an intellectual level. Like, what concepts do they not yet know or are they not yet familiar with? But that's really only part of the story, and when we're trying to assess what we need to communicate or how we need to communicate it, part of that process is the information we get through observation about where we feel like they're at, what may be in their way, what else is going on that may shift their perspective. Sometimes our way of describing something just doesn't resonate because it calls upon images or things that don't mean anything to them. So understanding that there's more to communication than just whether or not we got the facts across.
Right. Well, my first question for you would be, what do you feel is the primary reason that people continue using ineffective means of communication, even when they know the methods they're using are creating pain and disconnection in their lives? You know, for example, in my career of pretty much 25 years now, over and over again, I've watched spouses and family members literally go at each other tooth and nail.
Yeah.
Trying to get the same point across, but when I'm doing group coaching or marital coaching or family coaching, I see that they essentially repeatedly try to put a square peg in a round hole.
Mm-hmm.
Could you share some of your insights as to why you feel people will repeatedly bang their head against the wall, metaphorically?
Yes, I can share, and I'm sharing really as someone who's out in the field observing and making anecdotal observations, as opposed to giving a clinician's perspective on this, you know, like a clinical psychologist or that sort of thing. But,
well, I think that might be better, because judging by the look of things, clinical psychology hasn't really put much of a dent in anything out there.
Well, I find that no matter what, there are always people who get it or don't get it, regardless of, you know, training or background or what have you. And to some extent, when we understand it, when we know that we're in the presence of a truth, we feel it. And so sometimes that's all that needs to be said. But I also tend to be the queen of disclaimers. So I want to just put it out there of what my background is on this and where my perspective is coming from. And I do think that that what you're describing is a shared phenomenon. It's not necessarily expressed or manifested in the same way for all of us, but there are parts of our lives that we are banging our heads against some metaphorical wall, where we have tried what we feel are all the tools that we're familiar with at our disposal, and we keep coming up without getting the result that we're after. And whether that's the exchange with another party or any other kind of result. And so I think your question is a very powerful one, and it speaks to a lot of different things. And so the answer is kind of multi-tiered from my perspective. And that's that we bring to any situation the level of awareness and conditioning that we have in that moment. And so there are times where the perspective isn't there to step back and find something new. And so we may not know any better. So we keep doing what we're doing because at least we know that it leads to screaming, and screaming is familiar or what have you. I think that there are many different reasons why we may continue to try the same thing that led to an unsatisfactory result. in the end, it's up to us to broaden our awareness and to devise new strategies. And that comes from letting go of the other aspects that we feel like we're holding on to because they're familiar. Let me see if I can continue to put this in different ways, because I find that when we talk about these kinds of concepts, there are so many different ways in which we come to them as different as individual people, that you describe it in one particular way and it resonates with some folks, and then describe it another way and then more people get a sense of what we're saying. But if we don't know any better in the moment, if we don't know what else to do, and we're not ready to let go of the anger or the resentment that we have toward that person or that situation in that moment, then we're not going to be in a space to find a new solution, to recognize some other role model that may be out there modeling some other behavior or some other advice that we got from somebody else who we didn't want to hear from, who's suggesting the very thing that might change this up. So we may be boxing ourselves into a corner by either things we're not ready to let go of or awareness that we don't realize that we're missing in that moment. Now, there are other reasons why sometimes we can go ahead and keep forging into areas that we know are going to be painful or disconnected, but then we get into like the territory of hidden agendas and whether we have consciousness or not about them and that sort of thing. You know, in an optimal world, you know, we're capable of doing our best and hopefully we're going to do our best, but even that best has limitations. So that, and those limitations are okay because they keep changing, right? We're always breaking our own barriers, hopefully. It's a day-to-day, moment-to-moment growth. And sometimes we can undermine ourselves, our own communication, by doing something like being vague. And that vagueness can come from a lack of awareness, or the vagueness can come because on some level, whether we're conscious or not, we don't want to be clear because we might, by being clear, give up control of the situation. And maybe on some level we understand that, whether we're conscious of it or not, on some level we might understand that. Or by being vague, we don't need to be held accountable, so better to keep things kind of where you don't understand where they're going. Or by being vague, we can't be told that we're being wrong, or we can't get caught doing something wrong. So there are a lot of different nuances, and I hope I'm not jumping into too many tangents here in addressing this issue of why sometimes we stay in the area that we know is not going to get us where we're going, and we don't necessarily know how to pull up, look around, and find a new solution and let go of what we need to let go of in order to try it. There's definitely a lot at stake, whether we know it or not.
Yeah, it seems to me like what you're describing is, if I could use an analogy, if all you've got in your pocket is a hammer and you need to open a beer bottle or cut some cheese,
yeah,
and you don't know what else to do and you can't do it with your hands, then the beer bottle has a new form of opener called a hammer, and cheese has a new knife called a hammer, and sometimes we find out just about how dynamic a hammer is, and other times we find just how terribly it doesn't work.
Right.
Is a little side question for you here. Have you identified qualities in people that are apt to recognize the need for change in their own lives, whether it be physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual? In other words, if you looked at a cross-sectional area of the population, or you were to go through a given family, for example, you can find right within a given family that one or more of the siblings is more chameleon-like, more capable of adapting, yet within the same family you also have other members that seem belligerent or dogmatic to the point of their own demise. So have you identified qualities that make for a more favorable form of adaptability with regard to the environment of communications?
Wow, what a rich question. What I would say is that what I've noticed, while there are qualities, I think it really boils down to a perspective. I mean, in terms of qualities per se, I think curiosity is essential. That people who are looking for a new way, have to be curious enough to look for a new way. There has to be something in them that's looking, that seeks improvement. Now, the flip side of that is sensing always that something's wrong. So there could be a dark side to that, and whether or not that sinks someone into despair or inactivity has a lot to do with that person's own perspective on life and whether or not they're going to seek the light or stay in the dark. But in terms of managing change, that ability to welcome change, to feel open, even when there is an unknown element, that's the whole difficulty with change and expanding and leaving our comfort zone and all of that, is that there's a sense that we may fail or we may suffer because we don't know what we're doing. And people who are looking to shift their communication higher and higher or into a realm that serves a greater and greater good and continually make those observations within themselves when they are not representing that or not coming from that place, there has to be the ability and the resilience within the self to tolerate that they're not serving that greater good in that moment and to, through the drive that is in them, to follow their instincts to seek something richer and greater. So it depends a lot on the perspective of the person, whether or not they're able to release attachment to perfectionism enough in the moment, or whether or not for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, karmic or whether it be conditioning, or some would say that they're connected, whether or not somebody's attached to being in a punishment persecutor kind of dynamic, where it's either I'm always doing something wrong, I can't do anything right, why should I bother? You know, to beating the self up, you know, you did this wrong again. So if they're caught in that kind of mechanism because it enables them to not have to move forward, or it enables them to continually reaffirm that they're not worthwhile as a person, and that just confirms their belief over and over again that they're not worth it, then those people are not necessarily going to rise up. But given a safe space, we're all able to make a change, which is what's influenced me as a teacher, is to continually look for opportunities to create as safe an environment as I can in the moment for risk to be taken. Because what you're talking about in terms of the way I'm hearing it, Paul, that's that looking, that seeking to enhance our skill set and our vibration even as beings, it comes from the readiness to take a risk.
It sounds to me, really, and my own observation is that in order to be a dynamic communicator, you really have to be a courageous person, don't you think?
Yes. Yes. But it doesn't always look the way we think it's going to look, that courage. You know, you can see somebody, you can have a conversation with them, and you think, my God, that person's afraid of their shadow, right? But in their own way, in their own quiet way, they are exercising huge feats of courage. They're committing huge acts of courage in their daily life. And because it's at a level that might not be detectable to other people, they don't see it in them. So we if we look for the courage in that person, then we can cultivate it and we can support each other that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think my observation is that people are more willing to be courageous with the familiar than the unfamiliar. For example, it takes a lot of courage to repeatedly use a dysfunctional communication model when it creates pain for you, the individual who's trying to be heard. So, you know, it's what I see is it's almost like the drug addict that has to hit bottom in order to have the courage to overcome an addiction. Whereas the individual, certainly all of us have courage because we're here, and life is a series of exchanges that, you know, at any given moment can go yin or yang.
Yeah.
You know, therefore, it seems like the great communicator is the one who is, you know, more willing to go outside their model of courage.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and I think there are many different ways to take the dynamic that you just expressed and perceive it. And in terms of somebody in that dynamic of repeating familiar behavior, you know, where's the courage in that? You know, for a person who looks for growth or who is looking to constantly shift into another paradigm, to them, that would be, to repeat the same painful behavior would be scarier, would let's say, represent more suffering. But for the person who's not ready, right, the person who's not in a space where they could embrace a change or even envision a change, it may take less courage. It's kind of like negotiating. You know, you always think about what the other side is going through. How much are they giving up, or how much are they extending themselves, and what are they gaining and what are they giving? You know, whether or not an act takes courage is a really, I believe, is a really individual situation.
Yes. One of the things that I teach myself and have noticed to be an important element in communication is for the conscious communicator, I believe it's important to recognize another person's natural rhythm of communication. I'm just wondering, if you're communicating with somebody that has, let's just say, a radically different rhythm to your own, how important do you feel it is for you, the individual who's trying to get your point across, to adapt to the other person's rhythm?
Well, just so that I know that we're all on the same page, that I know really what you're referring to specifically, can you round out for me a little bit more about what you mean by rhythm?
Sure. You know, there are people that will talk. Hello, Eileen. It's great to have you on the show here today. I'd really love to talk to you about communication. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself, Eileen? And before you can even get five words out, well, that's really great. What about, you know, you know, whereas if you're more the introspective communicator and you're more inclined to be fully present with the person's words and not be formulating a response in your head, they're getting the message out. You know, for example, and you know, because I communicate with a huge number of people in my work, as you can well imagine, one of my challenges as a teacher is that more frequently than not, before I can even finish a sentence, a student or an employee or somebody will just butt right into the middle of one of my sentences and give me what they think is the answer, but because they have not even heard what I was saying, not only do they essentially, you know, create more stress in the communications, but I find people that use that model essentially force their rhythm onto the other individual. And what happens is it creates stress. One of the demonstrations I give in front of large audiences, for example, is I'll take somebody like you. You know, how tall are you, Eileen? You're, what, 5'3", 5'4"?
Just about 5'3". I think I'm a little under, actually.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know, dynamite comes in small packages, doesn't it?
I think so.
So if you and I were you know, like if you and I were hanging out together and talking together like we recently did at a conference, where were we? We were in Las Vegas, weren't we?
Yes, exactly.
So as we were walking out of the building chatting, you know, if I was taking two steps for every one of yours,
yes,
and you were trying to talk to me, well, within 2 minutes, I'd be 40 feet away from you. So in order for us to communicate, you'd have to yell at me.
Right.
Have to yell at you, because the rate that I naturally walk could be a lot faster than yours.
Mm-hmm.
Same way, if lovers are out on a walk and the male's 6'3" and the female's your height,
right,
male has to adjust his rhythm in order to maintain a relationship with his partner. I'm just curious as to your feelings with regard to the importance of allowing each individual to establish their own natural rhythm as a necessary means of communicating.
I understand what you're saying, and my take on this is that there are a few factors that will drive that dynamic that happens between people. Generally, the more aggressive of the dynamic can overtake as well, or the person with the most awareness might be the one to make the most take the most action toward the common good. But a communication in its essence is an exchange. And so my perspective on this is that it's the responsibility of both parties. Now, if I have a particular dynamic or style as a communicator, and honestly, because we are all complex people, we have many. If you look at the way you will talk to three different people within the course of an hour, you may all be authentically coming from the core of who you are in each one of those exchanges, but you'll probably have a slightly different way of talking to people because you have a different relationship with those people, and the chemistry between you is different. The dynamic is different. And so the communication that two people have with each other is unique and special to them and to that moment and the event and what the communication happens to be about and all of that. And in terms of how sensitive do we need to be to another person's rhythm, I think if we're looking to communicate with somebody, we need to be aware. Now, to the extent of how much do we shift or change to meet in the middle, it goes back to, for me, a lot of different factors. I just had a very frustrating exchange on the phone today with the tech support for the computer. I don't know. Have you ever tried to do that, Paul?
Well, enough times that I've become savvy enough to delegate those types of tasks to people who are more patient than I am.
Yes, if you want to see sides of your personality, that will get you there. And so what happens is that you get to a point where you're, you know, and in acting, this comes down to, you know, the core of so much of basic acting training, really fundamental work is understanding the dynamic and the intention, the role of intention, having objectives, whether or not they're conscious objectives or unconscious objectives. So when we enter into a dialogue, and that dialogue, again, is not necessarily he said, she said, but any form of communication, which includes body language, it includes inflection, it includes all the things you're not saying and the energy that you're in exchange with that other party and what that is all about. There is an intention, whether it's conscious or not, that is informing and driving it. And there are objectives. And depending on the situation and our connection to that and how high the stakes are, which is another big acting term, when you are fleshing out a scene, you're looking for where the points of conflict are, right, where the source of conflict is and how high the stakes are for one person versus the other. And that's how the dynamic of the dialogue or the energy of that exchange mounts and subsides and takes a shape. So when we look at when we're entering into an exchange with another party and their rhythm is very different, well, what are we trying to get out of that exchange? What are we trying to give? You know, what are we looking to have happen? And to what extent can we be open and fluid and adapt for each other? You won't change the core of who you are. You'll simply be responding to the situation.
Yes, I understand. I've just noticed in my own life that I have to be real sensitive to other people's communication models.
Yes.
Because, you know, my background being martial arts, boxing, kickboxing, and combative sports builds a communication/connection model.
Mm-hmm.
That is naturally very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that if I'm not careful and I let the essence of my athletic being start dominating my communications, then it's easy to get into a counterpunching situation without even realizing what I'm doing. So I've got to be very, very conscious of the individual's overall level of receptivity and sensitivity and the complexity of my communication. For example, if I'm talking about comprehensive anatomical
issues to a patient,
mm-hmm.
I have to slow my communications down so that I can more effectively connect to the individual and have time to watch their biological and psychological response to the communication, because if I go at my natural pace,
right.
time I pick up the signs of fear or insecurity that go with not understanding, I'm so far down the line that the person can just be boggled.
Right, right. Well, and you've cut yourself off from the reception, your reception, right? So if both parties are entering into an exchange, that means that there is not only that outward giving, but there's the receptive part. There's the receptive aspect of communication. So even when we're speaking, there's that receptive aspect. And so what I'm hearing as you're describing this situation is, by taking the time to be able to be open and be present, you can therefore be receptive in that moment, which is a huge portion of that, you know, of communication, and it helps balance the exchange.
Yes. Now, that leads us into my next question. You know, now this is a stereotypical type question, but stereotypes are real, and although they're, you know, the borders are very fuzzy, I'm going to ask a stereotypical question if you feel it can be answered stereotypically.
Okay.
Over the course of my life, I have found that women tend to communicate in different ways than men. For example, if you're going through a challenging communication with a woman,
mm-hmm.
less likely, in my experience, to be upfront immediately about maybe what's bothering her or even to defend herself if she feels attacked. And men are much more willing to be forthright and to attack if they feel attacked. And so what I often see in the relationship coaching that I do is that the woman doesn't communicate her wants, feelings, and needs directly to the spouse or the mother-in-law or the person, but does a very good job of performing what I call a Chinese fire drill, and that is telling everybody else in the room how she feels and what's pissing her off. And then the guy that she's trying to communicate to, maybe her father, her spouse, or whatever, ends up finding out secondhand. And that often triggers another round of, you know, punching bag activity.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, in your own experience, observed that there are sort of stereotypical differences in the way males and females communicate, or do you really feel that it's not a sex thing, it's really prior programming regardless of the sex?
Well, without feeling like scientifically like I have the qualifications to answer that, what I can tell you in terms of my own opinion is that I feel there are definitely certain things that for now are more ascribed to the masculine or the feminine. As we evolve as beings and as our lifestyle evolves, I don't know how that will shift. I think that there are other sort of more universal themes that are shared by both but may manifest differently or may be expressed differently when women are doing it than when men are doing it in broad general terms, but really we're talking about everybody. So in terms of some communication trends, I don't do relationship coaching insofar as the way you do, Paul. I work with people, and certainly that work impacts their relationships, but I don't have marriage coaching clientele. But what I can say is that you learn a lot about potential gender differences, at least with heterosexual people, gender differences when you're dating. And so I've certainly gleaned a lot of information that way. But there are other aspects that we forget about because we're in such a large country, and that is that there are cultural differences as well.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of what may seem like they're masculine or feminine may or may not be when we cross a border. So there's conditioning and cultural aspects that may also need to be weighed in addition to anything that may be, as you say, programmed in from a biological standpoint. And in terms of the scenario you described with there being a couple and a woman not expressing herself directly to the man, and by all means steer me if I'm getting this recount, if I'm screwing this recount up, but the male counterpart in this couple is in the dark as to what the issues are because she is assuming that he ought to get it, that she's laid down all these hints or whatever the situation should be so obvious, of course he should get it. And everybody else but him has heard all about it. Is that, did I replay that correctly?
You're a master player.
Okay. And I think we can all relate to this situation. And if we haven't had it in a couple, we may have had it with a friend. We may have had it with a loved one. We may have had it with a parent. We may have had it with a sibling.
Yeah, so I want to just restate that I'm very, very aware and very clear for the listeners hearing us that there are definitely men that behave in the model I've ascribed to a female here. What I'm saying is that in my experience, I've seen a trend towards women using what I would call passive-aggressive communication models, and I've seen men be more like a bull in a china shop. And so my question is, are there tips that you can offer for people, whether it be stereotypical or not, are there tips that an individual can offer? So if you're the husband who keeps hearing things secondhand,
right,
or the wife, regardless of sex, when this happens and it becomes obvious that it's not a one-off thing, but there's a pattern developing, how would Eileen Bergelson handle that situation? Let's just say that it happened to you in relationship to a boyfriend or a spouse. What would you do?
What I would do is I would take a breath and then I would try to see the world through their eyes for a moment. Because communication is so impacted by our own personal filters. So the way in which we see that exchange or the lack thereof of that exchange, you know, whether it's I come home and we're not really talking or things feel uncomfortable, what is that experience and how do I then respond? If I can take a moment to release what seems like a logical conclusion to come to when I look at the situation through my own eyes and I think, why doesn't he put this together and come up with the same answer that I do? I take a moment to stop and put myself through into what is my understanding of his situation. And then from there, perhaps by just giving myself that opportunity for distance and breath and to realize, of course, I don't have a crystal ball and I don't know where anybody's coming from, but it's a platform to then begin a conversation. And the difficulty is that no matter who you are in that scenario, it's not an easy conversation to have. And it doesn't always necessarily get tied up with a big bow at the end because, like anything else in life, it's this kind of dynamic and easing into a different pattern can take time and it can be trial and error. There will be bumps along the way. In terms of recognizing that filter or how that other person may be perceiving a situation, I'd like to draw a more concrete example just so we have something specific to refer to. If we look at this dynamic of, well, why doesn't he get it? Why doesn't he see? And I'm explaining it to everybody else if I'm going to assume the feminine role in this scenario. Where I come from, if I operate from a place of intuition, and if to me, showing love or being loving, demonstrating love, is to take an active interest and be curious and to think about what that other person wants and needs and what that other person is going through, then when I perceive that the other person is not giving me that, then I perceive that they are not loving or they don't care. Now that may be completely untrue. You know, and you, those of us who are parents of a certain generation and grew up in the U.S., I think many of us share this scenario where we watch the dynamic between our mom and our dads. And we looked and our dads were, you know, maybe labeled behind their backs, perhaps, or our friend's dad were maybe labeled behind their backs as not caring how mom felt about this or that or the other thing, or didn't notice if she got her hair cut or whatever. For the man, that experience meant something completely different. But for the woman, it was, well, he doesn't love me, or he stopped caring about me, or he's not invested in this relationship. And then if those beliefs are ignited, then behavior and communication is shifted before anybody has said anything. So but just by not having a real understanding and a platform to really speak to each other and understand that whatever value we might place on something may not be the same value or interpretation that somebody else is placing on it. We need to have that ground in order to meet in the middle. And without that, there's very little hope of being able to work together as a couple when there are difficulties. And by couple, it could be any two entities.
Right. Well, you know, what you've described to me as the way you personally handle that situation exemplifies my comment about rhythm, you see, because in order to take the time to put yourself in the role of the other individual, it means you either need to call a time out or you need to simultaneously listen to the individual yet remove your own projections from the process of listening, thereby making an attempt to clearly hear without your own filters, as you said, which requires a rhythm shift, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly will shift your rhythm the minute that we don't operate out of our regular place or use, you know, going up and responding differently rather than just reacting in that moment. Then, yes, our rhythm automatically will shift.
Paradoxically, one of the things that I've seen over and over again, even in my own life, is that I'm less willing to be sensitive to the rhythm, the wants, the feelings, and needs of other people if for some reason I'm afraid I won't be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, the more afraid an individual is that they won't be heard, the more important it is to essentially manage fear as a motive, because in most instances, if fear drives you into a communication model that hasn't worked or isn't working, then it just reinforces what you don't want.
Yes.
Have you got any tips for overcoming fear when communicating?
Yes. Start safe. Start with the breath. Start with yourself. And there is, if you look around, there are generally situations or people with whom you feel moderately more secure than others. So for some people, and again, because we're individuals, and what triggers us is highly individual, it's going to be different for everybody. And we touched on this in our CD that Penny and I did on communicating outside our comfort zone. So some of this may sound familiar to some folks. But basically, if you start with what you need to feel safe in that moment, and we build from there. So just to paint again a more concrete scenario, if somebody feels like there's really nobody in their life that they feel like they can really trust with what is most painful for them to express, or what feels like is their secret or their power or what have you, and instead they can take that time with themselves first to breathe and explore their feelings through either a journal or working with someone that they trust, and starting to feel like they understand themselves more and more and where they're coming from. And then from that place, there are so many different things. I know your PPS program is devoted to self-exploration and growth. So it's certainly an avenue for people to exercise this with in so many ways, and then to look for places to take the next risk they're ready to take. And by ready, I don't mean it doesn't scare you. By ready means you're willing to do it anyway. You don't know how it's going to turn out, and you're not necessarily without doubt, even in that moment of taking the step, it may still feel like, I'm not sure why I'm doing this anymore. I'm not sure if it was worth it. That's okay. But to feel like you can actually take that step. So for some people, it's asking a stranger what time it is. For somebody else, it's taking a bus to another town. You know, for somebody else, it's climbing up higher than 3 feet. You know, for somebody else, it's asking the other person out on the date. Whatever it may be. But then to be really aware, it's through the process of experiencing that risk of what it's like and that you're still here and that you can handle whatever happens, because you don't know what's going to happen. But you have the option of looking ahead and going, okay, whatever it is, I'll manage it. I don't know what it's going to be, but I believe in myself and I know I'll manage it. And so, you know, little by little we teach ourselves that. We reinforce that through positive experiences by taking the next step we're ready to take.
Sounds like good advice.
Good.
What are some key indicators that a person might use to determine that their communication style or methodology may need a tune-up or even an overhaul?
Well, I think that we're off to a really good start if somebody's asking themselves that question.
Right. They're not asking themselves the question, but they're listening to this recording, and how could we give them some indicators that maybe it's time to ask the question?
Right. Well, for anybody that may be out there, or if you know somebody and decide that you want them to hear, you want them to hear this point. The question is, you know, it goes back to that old question, well, how's that working for you? Right? So if you look at your life, if you look at that moment, or you look at that relationship that we have with our parents or our kids or our neighbor down the hall, and you go, wow, I still really wish that we could come to a better place. Or there are parts of this I really feel like I don't feel good about myself in this relationship. Those are indicators. Right. Any time that the response of others or our own personal response feels like it's out of alignment with our vision for what we hope and want and strive for ourselves, that sense of self that we have and who we can be in any given moment when we're coming from our highest place, when we feel like something is going on that feels like it's out of alignment, that's a signal.
Right. Would you agree that if we enter into communications with clear intentions of our desired outcome, and we're willing to be sensitive to whether or not our mode of communication is heading us toward that outcome or away, that level of awareness may itself be a necessary software update for our communication software.
Yes, I think there's more to that as well. I think that our awareness is simply that. It's what we are aware of in that moment. And I think there's a piece here that if we could all hold on to in these moments where we feel like we're losing ourselves, and that is that there's always more out there than we are aware of. And that's okay. We're not bad or stupid because of that. We're just alive, you know? And so if we hold a space for that as we're looking around to say, hey, I have an intention here about what I want to come from this exchange with this other person and how I want the communication to be experienced by both those people, right? We can have an intention. We can even be aware enough to look to see if it's working or not. But we may not necessarily be aware of what we're not aware of, which are the other aspects about it. We don't know necessarily when we see a response from somebody where it's really coming from, right? So if we can leave space for the fact that we're only going to know what we know in that moment, and if we feel like we are at least clear on that, we see that there's something we don't understand, that in that moment we could possibly then address it directly by either asking the other person or asking ourselves, like, why did I just get so angry when they said that? Right? We have those moments where we go in with the best of intentions. Maybe we're even going to have a difficult conversation, but we know we want to come to a peaceful resolution. We're willing to let go of what we thought was important in order to meet that peaceful resolution. And then the other party says something to us, and we're really, really, we're taken out for a moment, and we're really angry, or something else is triggered, and we didn't expect it. And before reacting and coming from that place of responding without really being connected to something larger, but rather reacting to that momentary surprise, we can take a moment and recognize, oh, okay, something new. Where's this coming from? And if I don't know, well, do I have to respond this way? Is there maybe another way? Can I give myself the space for this to go a different direction before things get out of hand? You know, how many times have we entered into an exchange with a strong intention and even a sense of what we perceive to be detachment to an outcome, and then all of a sudden something led to something and you don't recognize the experience you're having anymore? It sort of snowballs into something disastrously different. Have you ever witnessed that, or does that ring any bells?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was going to say that I often use the nonviolent communication technique of reinforcement, or when it's very important for me to feel the connection and the clarity of communication, I will often say, would you mind repeating back to me
what
heard me request, so that I'm confident that we're on the same sheet of music?
Yes.
Yet, you know, on numerous occasions, the person communicated right back to me per word, verbatim, exactly what I said, yet 20 minutes later, they were doing something completely different than what we had just discussed, which, you know, I think is that wild card you were just speaking of, in that there's a lot of unseen factors, and the ability to regurgitate something back to somebody is really not a guarantee that their perception or their reality is symbiotic with what you want it to be or need it to be in order to create the change, the flow, or the experience that you intended.
Yes, messages get convoluted when they go through the filter of another person, which is always, because we're always filtering on our way out and we're filtering on our way back in. But I think you bring up a really important point, which is in those moments, if we get, and through practicing, we are able to pick them up more and more when they're happening. So in those moments, to say, you know, in essence, hang on, let's recap. What was it that you just got out of that? Or here's what I'm getting. Can you tell me if I'm on the right track here? So if there can be a moment where there's an exchange about what the exchange has already been about, or where we think the other person's coming from, then it allows for a mid-course correction, so to speak. Right? They talk about, you know, managing change and being able to make mid-course corrections. It allows for a mid-course correction during some sort of communication exchange.
One of the techniques that my mother's husband, Alex Sensor, taught me, who's a very experienced teacher of nonviolent communication, is instead of just asking someone to repeat back to you, he also, when he feels it's important, which is quite often, if there's a request being made, he will often say, on a scale of 1 to 10, could you share with me your level of willingness to comply to this request? And, you know, I've often found it interesting that when you ask that question, frequently, even though the individual repeated it back to you verbatim and left you with the impression that they were very willing to submit to your request, that when you ask someone what their, you know, Alex calls it his willingness meter. You know, for example, he gives a great example. My mother gives this example. She says one time she asked Alex to do the dishes. She said, honey, would you do the dishes tonight? And he said, well, you know, if I get around to it, I'd be happy to do it. And then my mother came back and started, leveraging him, saying, well, you know, I do the dishes and I cook the dinner almost every night. I'm only asking you to do the dishes tonight.
Right.
And then, you know, he replied back to her. He says, well, Mira, to be honest with you, my willingness meter read about 7 to do the dishes until I heard the ultimatums, but now it's down around 2.
Right. And with his first response to her about if I get around to it,
yeah,
to me it says that his willingness meter was pretty low to begin with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It does. I also think this goes right back to the classic model of male and female communications. I think there's something in the male. Maybe it's remnants from our biological evolution through the chimpanzee or ape kingdom,
mm-hmm.
that the male seems to be very resistant to being, told what to do, whether it be a request. If it's packaged in certain language, any of us gets the sense that a request is actually a dictation.
Mm-hmm.
I just know as a male, mm-hmm. who is very male and who, you know, spent his entire life with males and was in the military with males, that there seems to be a natural resistance to any kind of dictation or request that is being perceived as a directive from a woman, and I really do believe that a lot of that is a remnant from our biological evolution, and that it's almost an instinctual behavior for the male to demonstrate dominance. And I also think that a lot of people work in environments where they are subordinate to supervisors, managers, directors, chiefs. And I think that when we come home, a lot of us want to regain our kingship or our queenship.
Mm-hmm.
How that comes across in intimate relationships, and as you know, a lot of business relationships become intimate. For example, I spend far more hours a day with my assistant, Vidya, than I do with my wife, bar none.
Mm-hmm.
We actually start communicating as though we were married, as opposed to her being, you know, my employee.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there is oftentimes a real need for us to become aware of whether or not it is our biology doing the talking, our psychology doing the talking, which would be our intellect, or whether or not we're communicating from the intuitive or the heart center.
Yeah, and it's a pretty controversial conversation to have, although it's not really controverted that these potential gender biases exist, but not just biologically, and I think that there's also a social reinforcement or conditioning reinforcement that happens in terms of whether or not somebody, because they're male, responds better to a request if it's phrased a particular way, especially when it's coming from a woman. And although I don't have a lot of research at my fingertips about this, I've certainly heard many experts discuss that there are ways in which we can address each other, whether it be male speaking to female or vice versa, and it would be more effective because we're sensitive to the fact that the person is coming from a different place and that there's a different dynamic there. But the other flip side of that exchange that was so, I think it was so relevant to so many people about the washing the dishes, is that the response to requests and answer that feels like it's not an answer to one party, but it feels like it's a response to another party, is another area that I think is ripe with potential associations with gender. And I don't think, and especially because not everybody is in this world is heterosexual either, I think that line is getting very blurred in terms of what is masculine and what is feminine. And as we evolve as a species, and that including being our spirit evolution, not only our biological evolution. You know, how will that then play out, you know, from one generation on to the next? But in terms of responses that we hear and what they mean to men versus women in a really generalized way, there is a behavior that I've seen men and women both commit toward each other that may be ascribed to one gender or the other normally, but I've seen it happen both ways, which is things like telling somebody what you want or what they want to hear so that they go along with you or that they don't provide resistance. Because what we're looking to do in our communication is always make sure that we have protected our own personal freedom, right? So I hope Alex doesn't mind us using this. This is such a beautiful example. So if Alex wasn't sure if he was going to ever feel up to doing the dishes and he wanted to give himself the space not to do the dishes if he found other things more interesting to do or more of a priority to do that night, his response meant that to him. And maybe to your mom, I don't know, that didn't feel like an answer. You know, men like less details if we're going to be very gender, very broad scope and generalize things. Many people will say men really prefer less details because that means clarity in the message to them. Whereas women, generally, we tend to prefer having more details because the additional information means clarity in the message. So for your mom, maybe that message was missing what felt like a concrete response. So then she pushed for a concrete response, and what she got was pushed back from him.
Yeah. Are there some Empower Speak tips for improving communications when a person feels afraid or afraid to be honest about their wants, needs, and feelings? In other words, if you, let's just say, here's a common scenario I've had to deal with too many times to count.
Mm-hmm.
One spouse wants a divorce, and they are just deathly afraid to break that news. Another one is many people I've worked with and coached want to quit their job, but they're very, very afraid to announce that, not only to their family members, but to their boss. Did you share Eileen's approach to how to handle communications that are, you know, maybe potentially essential communications, yet are often put off? For example, I've had people that I was one of them, you know, I wanted to get a divorce 8 years before I announced that I was initiating the divorce process.
Mm-hmm.
And I rationalized in my head that I was putting it off for the benefit of my son,
mm-hmm.
yet at some point I became clobbered with my own realization that I wasn't doing my son any favors whatsoever. I just basically gave him an 8-year training program on how to live with somebody you really don't want to live with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could you offer up some of your own insights as to how one might be able to negotiate their own inner challenges?
Yes.
How to, you know, come on board with the reality of what you're feeling and communicate that.
Right. I think the first place to start is to address the issue of time that you brought up, that sometimes when those feelings start to stir, and even if we have moments where we feel like we're clear, but then we back off from them again. You know, if we take that 8 years, there are so many people out there who it's 8 minutes, 8 days, 8 centuries, you know, whatever it may be, before they get to the place where they can actually take that definitive action. And during that time is also a process. There may be something else going on during that, and, you know, I'll just say 8 years because we're really just talking about the unit of time, right? What feels like the time from between which I had the idea of what I needed to do and I actually did it. But that time is actually more valuable than that. And while on some level we all want to be able to consolidated as much as possible, and it may be for the greater good of all if we are able to consolidate the time. Recognize that if we are taking that time right now in our own lives, if we feel like we're keeping ourselves in a holding pattern and we want to move forward to that place of action, then the question really needs to be, it's like, okay, well, what is it that I'm still working through here? Is it that I want permission, or I want to feel like I've tried everything, or that there's no hope left? What am I really waiting for here? Am I waiting for her to hate me so much that I don't have to worry about the fact that I don't like myself? Or am I looking for to see that this is hurting someone else just as much as it's hurting me, so I feel justified in leaving? You know, and again, I'm not speaking about you specifically at all. I'm taking this out in a completely general term now for anybody that's in a position where they're looking to take action in their own life in a situation that's difficult. So if we can get real with ourselves about why we're taking that time, then we may be able to recognize whether or not we still need that time anymore.
Right.
There may be other things going on that we just haven't been ready to look at, and that's okay too, but we just getting real is what gets us forward, gets us to the next place. And then in terms of, you know, how do we then enter into that exchange when it's time to do it? And that is to remember, again, like any other exchange, you know, it is about both parties, and that person may or may not be able to come from their highest place. They may not be able to represent to you their most generous self in that moment. Instead, you may see the very thing that we're afraid to see, which is that person not responding with acceptance for what we have to say because they believe things need to go another way, or they're not busy they need to continue blaming or whatever the situation may be. And it doesn't make them bad, and it doesn't make them unevolved or unenlightened. It just makes them human, and this is their response in their moment. And, you know, we just need to concern ourselves with ourselves and what we bring to this exchange. And so if we can remember that the steps that we're taking, that action that we're taking, is really with the best interest of everybody. And I'd like to paint again another concrete example where we can fool ourselves into thinking that it may be not, taking that action maybe not be in the other person's best interest too, it's just in our own best interest. And that would be like in an abusive situation, if somebody's being verbally abusive or otherwise. And the person who's been the object or the person who's been the recipient of that abuse finally gets to a point where they realize, okay, I don't want this in my life anymore. It's not healthy for me. It's not helping me be who I can be. And it's not helping me live the life I want to live. I want out. Now, that's all you need to know to make the change. But what will help us come to a place where we can actually have that, take that action and enter into that exchange with that other person is recognizing that while that other person may feel like losing you, right, or losing whoever that that recipient of the abuse is, losing their partner would send their world to a crashing halt, and maybe they'll just cease to want to live, or maybe they'll become destructive and break out and harm other people. Who knows? That doesn't mean that staying is serving them. It means that the choice that they're going to make when you leave is to be destructive. And those are two different things. Serving everybody's highest good is not always neat, and it's not always easy, and that's why we resist, that's why we hesitate, that's why we procrastinate, is because on some level, we understand that. And so the main thing is to, of course, as I said, I think when we were talking about just, you know, in a more mild way, how do we step outside our comfort zone and be more comfortable with risk? I mean, this is a really, what you're asking is a question that really, again, speaks to risk. And finding a safe place to connect and be really clear of about where we're coming from. And that's sometimes what that incubation time is about, you know, and sometimes it's about getting permission we think we need from ourselves or from the world around us. And if we start with ourselves and we start with that safe place to connect, then our awareness builds. And as our awareness builds, our confidence in who we are and our ability to be ourselves builds, right? Because we begin to know it on a cellular level. We are the ambassadors for ourselves. We're the ambassadors and the advocates, right? So when we know that and we're confident in that, we know ourselves well enough to get a sense of how we can actually act as an ambassador and as an advocate for ourselves and for the world as a whole. When we know that, then we're in a position of strength. And when we're in a position of strength, we can connect to ourselves and exchange with others from a place of enough detachment that we can see the action through, even in the midst of difficulty. So I would say, you know, if we're asking for steps, it's the same steps. We want to put ourselves in a safe place and start practicing honesty, practicing introspection, practicing clarity, practicing readiness, practicing risk, practicing coming from a place of making choices that serve yourself and do no harm. And in doing this, we build our muscles to do it, our ability to do this, and our awareness grows and grows so that we're able to be quicker and more understanding in any given moment of the particulars at hand. And then we can keep edging our way outside of our comfort zone. And that is why you brought up EmpowerSpeak. That's why I designed EmpowerSpeak the way I did. I mean, we did it for a very particular reason. And that's also why Penny and I recorded that topic, because it's such a relevant topic. All of us have these areas where we are still stepping into a place that's scary and unknown and dark, and we're wondering how to continue to move forward.
It's evident to me, from my own experience, and you're just reinforcing it, that an individual's self-esteem is really a major catalyst to successful communications, isn't it?
Yes, and we have a lot of old and sometimes negative associations with that term, you know, self-esteem. You know, there's a lot of different things that I think we attach to without even being aware of it. And with the concept of self-esteem comes maybe a base reality, but then there's all the other attachments that we throw onto it. But yes, that sense of self, of who we are and our place in this world to be fully who we are, and that can be a contributing energy in this world. Yes, it's key.
Yeah, this is why I teach the model I, we, all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is my belief for, you know, lots and lots of reasons that we are each 50% of every relationship we have with persons, places, or things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in order for you and I to have a balanced relationship, I have to be willing to let you have your 50%. In other words, I have to be willing to share the floor, mm-hmm. share the motive, share the experience. And to the degree that I dominate you, then you lose a portion of your 50%. And paradoxically, if that is the model that you were raised with to be domineered,
mm-hmm.
that may very well be normal for you, but that may very well also be the point of pain in your life as you continually give yourself or your rightful connection to the other individual as an equal partner in any relationship. And paradoxically, the individual who, say, has gained 40%, so that makes the relationship 90-10, really didn't gain anything but lost a tremendous amount, because to the degree that one is communicating with another person and ineffectively domineering them, they are losing themselves, because the whole point of communication is connection as a source of co-creation. And if I am communicating with Penny, let's say, and I'm domineering her and taking 40% of her individuality away, then I really have diminished my relationship with her significantly, which means I've reduced my power to co-create by the very measure that I've diminished her power to communicate.
Right. You lose in the process.
And this is where I feel self-esteem, or if you want another term, acquiring a healthy ego or relationship to self is so critical, because in my observation, until an individual has good communications with themselves as an inner reality, in other words, when Paul Check's talking to Paul Check runs the risk of suffering all the communication deficits with himself that he has in his communications with others.
Sure.
So my observation and why I teach the PPS practitioners to do, you know, and I take them through numerous inner exploration drills and we look at the source of each individual's ideas. In other words, where did your ideas about food, sex, money, religion, love, creating, et cetera, come from? And it's amazing when I take people through this process of self-analysis how, on average, probably 90 to 95% of almost every thought and decision that moves through their head can be tracked directly back to mother and father.
Mm-hmm. And that's just what we're aware of in this life.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Yeah.
But the reason I bring this up is because one cannot enter into a dialogue with themselves until they are conscious of the source of the thoughts that they're having and able to differentiate whether those thoughts are actually their own or whether they're just programs reverberating inside of their head.
I would add to that that process that you're describing is one that is continual.
It is absolutely continual, and it's even more continual to someone who is on a journey to self-realization, because to the degree that you're in the journey, you're in flow, which means you're in flux, which means you could literally be a different person every day. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the sources of stress that Penny has, is because frequently she gets feedback from people in the field that students are afraid because they never know who's going to show up on stage when I get there, because people that have followed me for multiple years have made the comment that this guy's different every time I see him. I never know who the hell I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And they're speaking it as a negative. And fortunately, I'm married to Penny. She is very good at turning that around. And she says, well, you know, he is in the business of self-development.
Right.
And if he wasn't changing, then probably none of these new programs would be here.
Right, which is an invitation to them to recognize another perspective on the same situation.
Right.
So what a gift. What a gift she's giving them.
Yes. So, Eileen, could you share with me what you might consider some absolute no-nos of communication?
Talk about old patriarchal concepts. Yes. Yes, I can. Disregarding the other party. You know, disregarding the fact that it's an exchange. So what the other party may need, who they are, the fact that they have a right to their own dignity.
Okay.
Right? Disrespecting the other person. And by doing all of these things, we are dishonoring ourselves. So it really does come back to bite us anyway. Disregarding ourselves, our own integrity, our own honor in an exchange. That's another thing that will silently erode our self-esteem, as you so eloquently put it.
Right.
Disregarding the other party, yourself, your integrity, your honor. I would say another no-no is appropriateness, right? It's a show of wisdom on our part as well as a show of respect on our part and a dignity for them if we are choosing things that are appropriate. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you second guess within an inch of somebody's life what they could or couldn't hear, but understanding that you have a goal in entering into any dialogue and there's an exchange that you hope to occur in that communication, and understanding that party has an identity, that party has a frame of reference, and that situation may be specific, and choosing wisely.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there others, or can I ask the next question?
Oh, please, by all means ask. And I think those are the biggies, really, you know?
Yeah. Now, I have some examples of this myself, but I'd love to hear your feedback. When are there times when using no-nos can be effective, or do you believe there is such an opportunity?
I just flashed on Siddhartha when you asked me that question. Oh, my goodness. You know, I'll talk to you from the earth plane for a moment, if you'll indulge me.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm here.
Oh, great.
From HR. I can't promise my head's there, but my body's here.
Right. I think that for now, to the extent that of what I'm personally capable of, it depends on the stakes and the priorities. There are times where I don't think stripping another person of their dignity in any normal conceivable situation would be necessary. At the same time, there are extreme circumstances where you may need to be dishonest. You may need to act with a compromised level of honesty, or some might even say integrity, you know, whether it be hostage situations or extreme situations. Now, if we go to something a little bit more pedestrian, and we go back to this morning and my incredibly not intimate conversation with the folks at Beep Computers, who have their technical support folks, there were times when my tone was not generous. There were times when I interrupted, which is disrespectful behavior, right, when we constantly overrunning somebody. And it was done consciously on my part because I had been told the same thing over and over again, regardless of how many ways I was reframing a question to try to net a different result. And in my toolbox, I was coming up empty again. So, you know, I reached for the hammer. But I don't think that that's necessarily justified. I just don't know any better yet.
yeah, but
you know, I think that the dues of communication are nourishing, and that we all come from Don'tville some of the time in little ways without even realizing it. You know, we accidentally, you know, go on automatic pilot when we ask a question for 2 or 3 seconds during the response and go, and then start with the next thing we were thinking of the moment they mentioned something else 5 seconds ago. I mean, we all have those moments where we check out and we disregard something, right? Or we inadvertently do something that may be disregarding somebody's sense of dignity by making a comment that wouldn't make much sense if you thought twice about it. So we just got to pay attention, do the best we can, and forgive others and ourselves graciously, and continue to look inward and move forward.
Yeah. The reason I asked the question is, you know, because there are people that hold, you know, rules fairly staunch in their, you know, own approach to things. And I'll give you an example. I once was giving a lecture in Toronto, and a friend of mine invited a pretty famous man to come sit in on one of my lectures. And after the lecture, we were spending a little private time together, me and I believe Penny might have been there, and my buddy. And the man that he brought said, "You know, I really thought your lecture was good overall, but," he says, "I was really disappointed and put back by your swearing."
Mm.
He says, I didn't think there was any need for that. I think you lost people there, and you certainly lost me when you did that."
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I said, "Well, you know, I understand your point, but I would like to point out that there was about 235 people in that room that ranged from 19-year-old rugby players to young soldiers that are trained to kill a commie for mommy to you in a $2,000 suit at, you know, 50-some-odd years of age and life experience."
Mm-hmm.
And I informed him that if I pitched that lecture at your level, then you would have probably saw 15 or 20 young, rough-and-tumble males walk out of there feeling like they were sitting in a in the church pews. And at the same time, it is my belief that anybody of your maturity is capable of sifting through the adornings or the cuttings to connect to what the true message is."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "The reality of it is my message needs to be heard most by the people that are the most entrapped. And those people typically use a communication style which is more akin to the one I use than the one that you're proposing." So I said to him, I said, "Now, if you reflect back on that two-hour presentation, if you understand what are called meme structures, so values memes, you will see that I was actually playing values memes like a pianist plays a piano,
mm-hmm.
and I was customizing my message and saying the same thing over and over, but using the different values meme structures to get the point across.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, well, I don't think you're ever going to be a successful communicator or speaker using that kind of language. And I said, well, that's interesting, because last time I counted, I had 7 speaking awards. And while a lot of the things that I do go completely against what you might learn at Toastmasters, at this point, I've been probably more successful than anybody I know at filling lectures and conferences.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting about this exchange, Paul, to me, in listening to your recounting of it, is that after the first few moments, it was no longer a discussion about, it was no longer a discussion that was triggered by the experience of him being in the room and responding to you as a speaker and coming up to have an exchange with you, to express a share to you. It kind of became, it changed, the nature of the conversation and what it became about changed into justification. Who's right, my way or your way?
Right.
Right? And so it's interesting that, and if that's, and that's certainly an exchange that you could have with somebody, right? We can always let our exchange shift into other things. It could shift into that if we wanted. Now, if you came away from that exchange feeling uplifted because it got you juiced, or annoyed because it annoyed you, you know, it's your decision to make whether or not you want the conversation to make that transition if it starts to head down that path the next time. But it's interesting how he came up, and for whatever his toolbox was that day, he was sharing his experience with you. You know, here's how I experienced you. You know, he's not concerned about the fact that there are 200 and whatever people in the audience, because that's our job as speakers is to think about everybody in the room. And one of the reasons actually why the next time I'm speaking at ECA, they actually are giving me a slot to talk to people about how to give constructive feedback, is because we often don't know how to express something that might be interesting information, if not helpful, to the other person without keeping it so personal that the other person's thinking, well, I'm thinking about 57 other things as well, so how can I just cater to you?
Right.
Yeah, so it's so interesting to see this exchange and how it can totally take a new direction. Did you resolve it with him?
Well, you know, I didn't really feel that I needed to take responsibility for resolving it.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, it was his opinion.
Right.
And out of respect for him, because
yep.
he was essentially, I don't really know how to classify it. It was half accusing me of inflicting the audience with what he considered to be inflammatory commentary or corrosive commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And, my modus operandi was I have to use different value structures to address different individuals.
Right.
And so, because I know who I am and I know exactly what my intentions are,
mm-hmm.
and I know exactly when I'm swearing and why I'm doing it, I didn't feel that I needed to, let it go past the point of just making my point and letting him make his point.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the whole point of me bringing it up was it was just one example of a legitimate use of what would be considered to be a speaking no-no or a communication no-no. And there's many others that I do. You know, I have been known to, full-on just leap right up on top of tables. And I have ripped my clothes off in front of an audience mm-hmm. to say, look, here's my introduction as to why I'm qualified to stand here and speak to you.
Mm-hmm.
because I'm wearing the qualifications. They're not on a business card somewhere.
Uh-huh. Well, that goes under that umbrella of appropriateness, right? And that, again, is an individual. That's a very fluid arena, right? It's not that umbrella is not finite. You know, whether it's a profanity issue or whether or not it's a nudity issue, or you know, what falls under appropriate is completely unique to the setting. And like you said, if you're making conscious decisions and given your toolbox in your in that moment and what awareness and choices that you're making, it may be the best tool you have. You know, and that may or may not be true 10 years from now. Who's to say? It could be the most effective tool till the end of time. It's an interesting thing when we're presented with those opportunities, you know, when we're confronted with someone who is having difficulty or it seems to meet our choices and have a different response than the one, of course, that we consciously set out and made them for. And, you know, in the case of this guy, I mean, I certainly have gotten all kinds of crazy feedback. and that's another thing we handle too, that because as an actor, boy oh boy, you get a lot of training, just on the job training, not real training, about feedback and people telling you all kinds of stuff. And in the case, like if someone were to come up to me and have something to say about it, and they were trying to give me a wake up call, right, which is sometimes the way in which the energy that somebody has. You know, you come from a military background, so, you know, the idea of defusing a bomb, probably pretty familiar to you, right?
Sure.
Okay, so, you know, if we look at it like this person just rolled up a grenade with the plug undone, this is waiting to explode and spray negativity all over the room just because they don't know any better, and maybe what their share is not harmful at all. Maybe it's not useful, but it's not harmful. And they're trying to express it because they either feel the need or on some level they think it would be helpful. So it's an interesting thing when we have those moments. I mean, you handled it the way you felt like you needed to in that moment. And I know in the past that people have come up to me and have had things to say, and I'm probably a lot less controversial than you on the platform, but there's always going to be somebody that doesn't like you or doesn't get you or finds you annoying or what. I mean, I know that there are people that have had strong reactions as well to me, and that's something I don't particularly enjoy. But if they are able to come up and voice them to me, as much as it's the last thing in the world I'd like to actually have to live through, it's become easier for me to live through them and actually something positive to come out of it. If I say in that moment, so that was whatever they expressing that it was for them, if it was that my language didn't speak to them or that it was too abrasive or in your case like the profanity, I say, well, thank you so much for letting me know how that experience was for you. No, those choices were actually made strategically and perhaps not necessarily for them to hit home with somebody who's bringing what you bring to the audience today. But I appreciate you sharing with me how your experience was, and I hope you got other takeaways from the lecture. So it's, you know, there's so many different responses that anybody is going to have to any situation. If your honest response in that moment was to respond the way you did for him, then, or with him, then, you know, you had as an authentic and as elevated an exchange as could be had in that moment by the two of you. And we just keep looking to raise the experience, you know.
So it sounds to me then, if I'm hearing you correctly, that there really is no no-nos in communication except the ones that don't work.
Well, you obviously, if the point is to reach out and have a meaningful exchange with other people, then we need to take them into account, right?
Right.
And we need to understand that they have value, even when we don't agree with them. And so if there is a way to honor that value, then I believe we're staying outside the no-no zone. And those moments when we inadvertently step on toes, we can honorably handle that too. We can do that without berating the other person or punishing them for expressing their opinion or even trying to squash them with our greater awareness or intellect or enlightenment or whatever. You know, we can do that. We can be generous in that moment. They can walk away from the exchange not necessarily knowing that we know as much as we know. We just have
right.
to come from that place.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, listen, Eileen, I really enjoyed the interview. I'm running out of time, but before we go,
mm-hmm.
I would love to have you share more about where people can find your Empower Speak lessons? I know you've got, I've listened to, I believe, 4 different CDs that you've did that you've created with Penny. Are those only available on the Czech Institute website, or where are those available?
They're available through my company, Life Moves Health, or through me here in New York, and through the Czech website. The Czech website is the only place that they can be ordered directly online through the shopping cart. Certainly people who are contacting me by email and want to place an order, that's how we're handling that here on this end. But, you know, I invite everybody to feel free to go to the Czech, to go to your website, because that's where they can, you know, listen to samples of the titles as well. There's a sample of all 9 CDs. We decided to do 8 in a bonus. So they're all there. And then, of course, anytime I'm at a live event, they are also for sale on site.
Okay, so that's for those people who may not know the Czech Institute's web address. It's www.thekinstitute.com.
Right.
Eileen, if people would like to find out more about your workshops or contact you for private coaching, how do they go about doing that?
They can email me, and I'll give you my website and my email address. My website is www.lifemoveshealth.com. So that's L-I-F as in Frank, E, M as in Mary, O-V-E-S, health.com.
Right.
And the email address is info@lifemoveshealth.com. And any inquiries that are sent to that general mailbox, if there's a specific inquiry that you're looking for an answer from me directly, we'll make sure that message gets to me. And as far as Empower Speak workshops, I know that we've got a few coming up through the Institute, actually, in Toronto and California, but they are finalizing new dates for them. If they were going to be this fall, we just finished New York just the other week, and
right.
I believe that Toronto and California are next, and the first in the three, the Breaking Through to Bring Out the Speaker in You, is what's coming up first, and then there's an advanced weekend, an intensive weekend of content development and advanced performance.
So the if I could get you to maybe just give us a brief synopsis of what kind of things that people would hire you for.
Mm-hmm.
I know that if somebody wants to improve their public speaking skills, that you coach that.
Yes, very much so. I'll work with folks who are looking to present or who are already presenting, or they're looking to create coursework or teach. So I will work with different people in different kinds of venues that they want to prepare for. So whether it's helping to get the PowerPoint to work, or even sometimes someone will have other materials like their manual or other postcards and things for me to go through with them to help their own communication style and who they are be more reflected more truthfully in all of that material, and also for the outlay of the course manual to make more sense and to be more helpful for students, as well as just the active skill set of getting up and delivering and feeling confident and designing the program so that there's interaction with the audience and that the environment that you want to create is there. So, yes, I do one-on-one coachings as well with people, as well as these workshops, in addition to my practitioner work as well. There are some people that are coaching for other reasons, though, because they just want to feel more comfortable when they communicate. And those sessions are worked the same, you know, on an hourly or half-hourly basis, whether they're working through trying to communicate more clearly in a relationship that seems to be proving difficult, or, you know, in a work situation or anything else, really.
Well, fantastic. And I know we're in the process of getting you set up as a PPS mentor.
Yes, thank you. I'm honored to be asked, actually. I wanted to thank you again.
Yeah, no problem. And it's my dream that by the time this interview hits the website for people's participation, that we will have your details on the website in the mentor section. So thank you. This has been a very interesting and informative interview, Eileen. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I wouldn't doubt it if we have more interviews to come together.
Oh, that would be very exciting. I look forward to it so much.
All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day, and I will look forward to sharing this interview with as many people as possible.
Thank you. Oh, thanks so much, Paul. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.